the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you...
Hello, I am your host, Athena Melville. In this August 2014 edition of Education Now, we welcome Dr. Kathy Morris. Dr. Kathy Morris is a professor of elementary mathematics education at Sonoma State University in Northern California. A math teacher educator for over 20 years, she is currently involved in a number of initiatives that support teacher leaders, coaches, and administrators to focus instructional goals on student thinking and the standards for mathematical practice. She is currently working on a book designed to help elementary teachers incorporate a wider variety of math lessons in their teaching. Kathy was a guest on Education Now in our July 2008 edition as well. So hello, Kathy.
Hello, Athena, and thank you for having me back.
Oh, it is just such a pleasure. I've been looking forward to it. Can you tell us what you've been doing since you were last on the program?
Right, sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things that's been really rewarding and has just finished up was we had a three-year grant to work with teacher leaders from Sonoma County up to the state line. We were working with teacher leaders kindergarten through 12th grade throughout Northern California, Mendocino, Sonoma County, Del Norte County, Lake, and Humboldt counties as well, and working with teacher leaders at every grade level and in coordination with their county offices of education to help each county in our region have a consistent way of implementing, rolling out the Common Core standards for implementation in the schools. And so that work was really rewarding, and as a result of that, that's led into this new project that I'm working on, which is based on what I learned from those teacher leaders, from their challenges, from their insights, from their excitement and energy. I learned a lot as well, and so I'm working on a new book to share those insights into ways that especially elementary teachers can diversify their math teaching.
Well, could you share something from this new project, Kathy?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. So this new project is really working to help elementary teachers learn to teach different kinds of math lessons. There's some research out there that has shown that in U.S. classrooms, roughly 90% of the math lessons that we teach, whether it's first grade or 12th grade, follow the same basic pattern, regardless of the topic that they're studying, regardless of the age of the students, where they are in a particular lesson. And so what I'd love to do is contrast, share a little excerpt from my writing that contrasts two different classrooms. The first classroom, I'm not going to actually read the excerpt. I'll just tell you about it, and then I'm going to, because it'll be familiar for all of your listeners. But then I'll read an excerpt from a classroom that's going to sound really different from what we're all used to. Both of these classrooms are fifth grade classrooms, and they're both studying volume, computing volume. And we all studied volume a long time ago probably, and volume is length times width times height. But these classrooms are going to be approaching this study really differently. Both have both of these classrooms have really good, conscientious teachers who know both mathematics and their students, and both of the classrooms have pretty typical students with a wide range of abilities and interests. And just to, so you get a picture of classroom one, it's probably a lot like the classroom you grew up with. So the kids come in from recess, ready for their math lesson, and on the chalkboard there, or the whiteboard, there's the agenda for the day's math lesson and some warm-up problems. And this routine varies very little from day to day, unless it's a day when there's a quiz. When the kids come into the room, they get out their notebooks, and they just sit right down and they do their warm-up problems. And while they're doing their warm-up problems, the teacher circulates around the room, checks off that everybody's done their homework. After about 5 minutes, the teacher helps the kids to correct the warm-up problems, and then they correct the homework. After all that correction's done, it takes about 15 minutes altogether, they dig into the day's lesson, and they're following the typical pattern we all might remember. In education, in classrooms right now, we're often calling that an I, we, you lesson. I, the teacher, give you a little lecture on the day's topic. We together are going to do some practice problems, and then you, the kids, are going to do some independent practice. So the teacher gives her mini lecture on computing volume. Then the teacher and the students do some what's called guided practice together. They work a few problems together, and then the students set to work doing the rest of their problem set. And if any of them finish early, then they get a chance to start working on the next day's homework. So that's classroom one. Now let me read you classroom two. Classroom two is going to feel very different from the lesson most of us grew up with. So you walk down the hall, and you visit another fifth grade classroom. These students are also returning from recess. However, in their room, instead of warm-up problems and an agenda, the teacher has projected a photo of a Barnes & Noble's semi-truck on the whiteboard. The entire length of the truck's side panel is covered with a giant image of books. As in classroom one, the kids come in from recess, and they take out their notebooks. Okay, class, says the teacher, what does this picture make you wonder about? Jot down a few mathematical questions this truck evokes, and then pick one problem to work on solving. You can use whatever tools you think might be helpful. After 5 minutes of quiet thinking time, feel free to find some other students who are working on similar problems if you want to collaborate. The kids busily begin scribbling ideas in their notebooks. A few pull out calculators. Others grab rulers. What questions would you want to work on? How might you get started? Here are a few popular responses from the students in this class. How many books are in that truck if it's full? Could that truck hold a million books? How would you arrange books if all the books are different sizes? Is there a way to do that efficiently? If a box of books holds about 30 books, because it would be too heavy for the bookstore owner to lift a book bigger box, how many boxes fit on the truck? After some silent work time, the room is abuzz with creative and engaged energy. The students mill around the room for a bit, trying to find someone to work with, and then soon there are clumps of boys and girls working together all around the room. Some work at their desks, some at back table, others on the rug, and a few lean on the counter on the side of the classroom. After about 25 minutes of collaborative work time, the teacher asks the students to create status posters reporting on the problem that they are working on solving, their reasoning, how they've been making sense of their problem and getting started on their solution, and some of the computation they've been doing. They're also asked to explain what they plan to do next. Once the posters are completed, they're posted around the room, and students, armed with sticky notes, take a gallery walk around the classroom to view the posters. As they read their peers' work, they post comments and questions for the poster makers. They pose alternative strategies. They praise or critique an element of work. They offer ideas for next steps. To conclude the day's lesson, the teacher gathers the class together for a whole group discussion on the kinds of math the students were observed doing during the lesson. The teacher highlights the key concepts of the day, that volume is a way that we measure three-dimensional spaces, such as trucks. And when we're measuring things, like rectangular prisms, it helps to start off by finding the length and the width and the height. The teacher also highlights procedures that emerged in many of the groups, as well as shortcuts and efficiencies that were used by just some groups. The day wraps up with a discussion of goals for the next day's work, when students will use their peers' feedback to revise and complete their work on their question about the book truck.
So it's clear that teaching is happening in both of these two classes, but the kids in both classes seem to be working on the same math content, figuring out volume. So do the differences in the way the lesson unfolds really matter?
Yeah, I would argue that the two lessons really are quite different. When we set students up in our traditional lesson where the teacher explains a procedure for, in this case, computing volume, and then the students work some problems together, and then students compute those problems, we find that one of the things we find is that lots of times students don't quite learn those procedures correctly. So some students in the class who are good at listening and taking things in quickly learn those procedures very quickly. They're very efficient. They can skillfully compute those things. And other students struggle and may mishear one little bit of something. And then essentially what happens is they're learning something erroneously. They're practicing it over and over incorrectly. Then that later needs to be unlearned and replaced with something else. That's really quite difficult for many kids. And also the research shows that style in classroom number one, where students learn one little thing and then follow that up with a lot of practice, is really useful for short-term memory and sometimes leads to success on tests and quizzes, but doesn't necessarily lead to long-term memory and deep understanding, nor does it lead to students being able to apply those mathematical skills to novel situations, for example, figuring out the volume of a truck. And the difference in classroom two is you'll see that there's a really different level of engagement for students. Students are really using things that they already knew and applying them to a new situation, so that learning is really much deeper. And they're, in fact, because in this room, in this particular lesson, students are coming up with their own mathematical wonderings. They're becoming agents of their own learning. They're the ones who are learning which tools to use, which computation methods to use. They're not being told, here's the formula to use. They're figuring out, this is the appropriate formula to use in this circumstance. They're posing problems that make sense to them and that are inherently more interesting to them. And so they're more invested in solving things. And those experiences are more likely to carry forward with kids in the future.
So do you feel that this emphasis on speed and memorization damages the kids?
Yeah, I really, really do. It damages, it leads to a couple of unintended consequences. So one of the things that is a result is that if we emphasize speed, we're actually de-emphasizing thinking. And the work that grown-up professional mathematicians do, that not just mathematicians, but anybody who uses mathematics in their life as an adult, whether it's for your hobbies, such as building things or cooking or sewing, those are some typical things. But square dancing is another thing. There are all kinds of dancing of most varieties, music, but also in professions, whether it's white or blue-collar professions. When we use mathematics as adults, what's important is that we think carefully and that we're accurate and that we can justify our answers. And if we emphasize speed, what happens is we're sending the message, actually, don't take time to think about it. If we emphasize speed, we're also saying to kids, okay, what really counts to be good at math is having a really good memory and following directions really well. And that's actually not the most important things for being good at mathematics. The things that are most important are reasoning, thinking, the ability to articulate your reasoning, to be able to have solid foundations on your reasoning. And there certainly are lots of times where being efficient, mathematically efficient, is very important. And so, but there's quite a difference between being fast and being efficient. Efficient includes the notion that you want to be accurate on track. And as teachers, we want to push that. We want to push for our students to understand. You want to be as fast as is reasonable to be accurate. And the minute you start losing accuracy, it's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. So now the yes, go ahead.
Add in there. Also, I mean, if you think about, like, when you're driving a car and you're driving really, really fast, like, eventually most of us are going to crash. And that's a metaphor that fits for schooling as well. And for many people, many of us as adults, we crashed in mathematics at a certain point when we were no longer able to go as fast or as we perceived the kids around us to be going. And we crashed. For some kids, they crash at about third grade when they can no longer memorize all of their times tables. For some kids, fifth grade when fractions and doing operations with fractions just becomes too hard and you can't go fast. And some kids, it's algebra or geometry or calculus. But most of us crash at a certain point. And part of that is because when we're going so fast, it's hard to see, first of all, it's hard to see where we are in the process and what we need to be doing. And it's really, at that stage, it's impossible to see where you've been and where you're going. And learning mathematics is really, it's a continuum of using these ideas, the foundational ideas that you've learned before, to help develop ideas about where you're going in the future. So if we're going too fast, we don't have an opportunity to tie all of that together, either as teachers or as learners.
Right. And memorization doesn't mean that you're absorbing the content.
No. One of the things that's nice in the new Common Core Standards, they use a different word most of the time. Rather than talking about memorization, which really points to something called automaticity, they use the word fluency. And what they mean by fluent is that you want to be able to have as much at hand as possible. And that the standards now try to use the word fluent to mean fast and accurate, the way that I was describing that term, kind of efficient. And it doesn't mean that everything is 100% absolutely memorized. It springs forth from your head, you know, just boom, there it is. But rather, as much as you can will come that way, but also recognizing it's a balance, that there's some things that you're going to have to take a minute to stop and think, and that's okay. That's human. You want to be quick and efficient with the things that you don't have memorized. Most adults don't actually have every single one of their multiplication facts memorized. I know which ones stump people. 7 times 8 is one that
56.
Some people, you know, for some people, 7 times 8 and 9 times 6 are very confusing. Right, they know they're both in the 50s, 156, 154. They're not sure which. Now, I know lots of tricks to help people know them, and there are lots of ways to know them. But one of the things, the difference between automaticity and demanding automaticity and demanding fluency, fluency would say, if you've got it, like you had that 56, boom, there it is, fantastic. But if not, I have an expectation that everybody can get it within 5 seconds. That's a very reasonable expectation. That's fluent. Within 5 seconds, a child could say, 7 times 8, I'm not sure, but I know 7 times 7 is 49, because pretty much every kid knows their doubles.
Mm-hmm.
7 times 7 is 49. But I want to have 8 of those 7s, so I got to add 7 more. 49 and 7 more, that's 56.
Boom. Right.
You can have it. You can have it in a few seconds. And that's actually more mathematically powerful for students than the absolute memory. Because
if
you can do that reasoning, one of the things that people don't know, people that we're just starting to be able to articulate in the world of math education, is the power of that reasoning. The child who can say, I can't remember 7 times 8, but I know that it's equivalent to 7 times 1 plus another 7, has just demonstrated an intuitive notion of the distributive property.
Yeah. Yes.
It's going to carry them over from arithmetic to algebra.
Right. Yeah, I call it math when that reasoning is there. And when it's just memorization, I call it arithmetic. Mm-hmm. But, now the truck lesson seems like a pretty big departure from the traditional lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other kinds of lessons that teachers might be more comfortable with?
Well, I think one of the things that we want to think about is not necessarily that every teacher needs to replace every lesson they've ever done and never engage in that traditional lesson, but rather to think about purpose. What's my mathematical purpose? What's my instructional purpose in teaching this particular lesson today? And so there will be days when that traditional lesson format is going to be perfectly appropriate. That traditional format is a great lesson to help students practice, right? When do we want to practice something? Well, you want to practice something after you've done a good bit of thinking about it and a good bit of learning about it. And practice is a kind of thing that we want to do to help students at a particular time in their learning to move from being fragile about something to being more solid. But that's not all, you know, not all of our instruction is about moving from being fragile to being solid. Sometimes what we want to do is really focus on the underlying concept. We want to focus on some lessons that would develop a concept. Sometimes we want to practice some lessons that are going to focus on application. Sometimes we want lessons that are going to draw out from the students, like in the truck lesson, their own knowledge and their own curiosity to use as the basis for building a concept. So the first thing to think about is, I'm not saying there's no place for a traditional lesson. But, for example, in the U.S., that traditional lesson is used about 90% of the time in most classrooms throughout the country. That's what the research has shown. And a lot of that other 10% is when kids are doing quizzes or tests. And then there are a few other lessons. In some high-performing countries, they spend a lot more time where the student themselves is doing the inventing or the exploring those mathematical ideas. And so, yeah, I've got quite a few other kinds of lessons that we might want to engage in. So, for example, something called a concept attainment lesson. Concept attainment lesson, here's another geometry example. Teacher might put up a shape on the board. Maybe they draw a circle, and they put that on one side of the board. And then on the other side of the board, maybe the teacher puts a triangle. And the teacher says, now I'm going to put things on two sides of the board here, and I want you to just look at them for a while and see what you think. And then on the side with the circle, the teacher puts some more shapes. She puts an oval, and she puts something that kind of looks like I would describe as a cloud, and she puts a semicircle. And on the other side, the teacher adds to the triangle and puts a square and a rectangle and a hexagon. And students start to think, all the things on the one side have curves, and all the things on the other side have no curves. I wonder what's going on here. And the teacher puts some more shapes and some more shapes. And the teacher can use a lesson like that to help students just begin to develop a concept of polygon versus non-polygon. Polygons have no curves, and they're closed figures. And we can do a lesson like that where we're not doing pages and pages in a workbook, but we're studying, thinking about different kinds of just the concept underlying that. Another kind of lesson teachers might do with kids would be to play games in classrooms. There are lots and lots of mathematical games, many of which can do as much to promote skill practice as a traditional textbook page and a traditional lesson, but there's a very different level of engagement for students. Another kind of lesson might be something called a number talk, or, you know, I've got quite a few others, a diagnostic lesson, re-engagement lesson, target lesson, but I think you're going to have to read the book to see some of those.
And project lessons.
Projects, absolutely. Projects, you know, 3 to 5 day project in a math class is one of the best things that we can do to help students understand that math isn't something that we just learn in one lesson and one page on that lesson. That sometimes there's a big misconception that kids have, and projects can really help us overcome this. Kids get the misconception that if you can't solve it in about 30 seconds, then you're probably doing something wrong. Because when we give kids a worksheet that has 30 problems on it, and we give them, you know, a half an hour to do it, we're saying everything on there should take a minute or less. Otherwise, you're doing something wrong. But math problems in the real world are messy. They have lots of information and different things that would get you interested in different pathways. They're not just little computations that take 30 to 60 seconds to solve. And so projects are a really important piece in this big picture of what are the different tools I want teachers to have in their repertoire. We want to communicate very clearly to students and to parents that mathematics isn't just something that takes a few minutes.
Right. And, you know, there are all kinds of tools that a person uses with projects, like maybe a protractor or a measuring a yardstick or a tape measure or, you know, all these different tools that a student uses doing a project, and there's movement involved. I think it's so gratifying myself, both the projects and the games. Are really satisfying. At least I've seen it really satisfying.
Absolutely.
For students.
And the projects, I think another thing that the projects do is they really communicate to students because projects are often interdisciplinary, meaning they often tie in science or art or history or statistics or some other, you know, some other field of study. They
right.
Also, or you might connect it to PE. It communicates to students that math isn't just this one thing that we only do in isolation for that 45 minutes during the school day. And that's a very important thing that students need to understand about mathematics. A lot of kids just think that mathematics is computation.
Right.
And it couldn't be farther from the truth.
That's right. Well, many of these lessons have in common that you've talked about is that students aren't focused exclusively on getting the right answer. That mm-hmm. seems like a big shift. Can you talk some more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about a mathematics problem, there are a couple things you could do with a mathematics problem in a classroom. So the first thing is you could ask kids to get an answer to it. But there are a couple of other things that actually support much deeper learning. So rather than thinking about the answer, we could ask kids to stop and think about the mathematical situation and ask them to make sense of the mathematical situation in which a problem exists. Or at even a broader level, we could take a problem and say, this problem is an example of a particular kind of mathematics. And let's think about what kinds of mathematics you can learn when you work on a problem like this and view problems as within a class of problems. The U.S. is particularly historically bad at this. In the U.S., you know, it's very typical that a teacher will say, how can I get my kids to think about this problem, and how can I get them to get the answer? And teachers in Japan, and this research I'm taking from Phil Darrow, who's one of the authors on the Common Core Standards, he found teachers in Japan, rather than thinking, here's a math problem, how can I get my kids to get the answer to the problem, they think, here's a math problem. How can I use this problem to help my kids understand the big math ideas that I want them to understand in this unit? And that's a really subtle but very important difference in the way we think about what there is to learn in a math problem. And so, this is an example from Phil Darrow. And again, he's one of the...
Phil Darrow.
D-A-R-O.
Yes.
One of the problems he likes to use, he gives this problem, and actually, he doesn't even frame it as a problem to start off with. He just says, a common green dragonfly, the fastest insect in the world, can fly 50 feet in 2 seconds. And he says to students or teachers that he's working with, just work on that for a minute. Now, American teachers and students say, well, you didn't give me a problem. And he says, well, just work on it for a minute. Like, think about that mathematical situation. This dragonfly can fly 50 feet in 2 seconds. And then he says, after he gives a good bit of time for people to think about it, he says, that's interesting. Okay. What mathematical questions could you write from that situation? And so students, rather than working on answer getting, they're thinking about what are the math problems in there?
Yeah.
What's fascinating is then they invariably come up with things like, this is dragonfly. It can fly 50 feet in 2 seconds. How far can it go in a minute?
Yes.
Ask questions like, okay, they can go 50 feet in 2 seconds. How long will it take for it to go a football field? So now we've got two kinds of questions. How far can it go? How long will it take? And then other people will say, well, how fast is it going? Like, how many miles per hour or how many feet per second, right? So there are three basic rate questions that come out of a circumstance. How far questions, how long questions, and how fast questions. Well, kids can generate all three of those questions, and then the teacher could tie it together and say, we are going to be studying rate and ratio. Great sixth grade topic.
Right.
We're going to study rate and ratio for a long time. And you know what? Here's a whole page of questions. Here's a whole page of workbook questions. I don't want you to find any of the answers to them. I want you to look at the questions, and I want you to sort them out and figure out which ones are asking how far, which ones are asking how long, and which ones are asking how fast.
Wonderful.
One of the things we do when we delay answer getting is we keep kids from learning wrong stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if we delay answer getting and help kids spend a lot more time in the understanding the problem and understanding what they're going to be doing, they're not learning incorrect procedures. We can kind of keep them from doing that page of problems where they did the same mistake over and over and over again. We can delay that. We can keep that from happening. So we don't need to spend our time kind of reteaching kids and reteaching them again and reteaching them again. Because once you learn something wrong, it's really difficult to unlearn it.
Yes.
It's much better to slow it down. Again, de-emphasize speed, but also de-emphasize that all there is to do in math is get an answer. There's a lot more for us to do. Helps kids really understand those mathematical circumstances. So it really supports the future.
Yeah. Well, lots of people feel that they just aren't good at math. Lots of students, and that includes some teachers and parents. What can teachers and parents do to help students avoid developing those feelings or to overcome them?
Well, one of the big things in the research, and this is particularly coming out of the educational psychology research right now, is there's a lot that we're learning about what's called a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. And so just to give you a little bit of background, this is the work of Carol Dweck. She's a professor at Stanford.
Would you mention her name again?
Yeah, Carol Dweck, D-W-E-C-K, and she's got a book that's called Mindset. And what she has found is that students that have a fixed mindset, they're the ones who kind of think, and their parents may think, that there's a math gene. They're kids that are good at math, and they're kids that aren't good at math, and it's just the way it is. It's kind of fixed. It's just the way it is. There are other people who believe, in their heart of hearts, they believe the way to be good at math is to work on it. And if you work on it, you'll get better. And I can work on this. It's something I can work on. Now, all of us in different areas in our lives have variations on fixed and growth mindsets. For me, it's hard, like, thinking about sports. Like, I always think, oh, I'm not good at sports. But the truth is, like, I know if I worked on it, I would get better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of those things. And so what they find is that people who have a fixed mindset about mathematics, they're people who kind of give up easily when something feels hard. They see effort as sort of fruitless because they think that if you're working really hard, it's because you're not good at it.
Hmm.
They're the people who think that if other people around them are good at it, they must then, and they're doing better than they are, then they're not very good. They kind of have a deterministic view about how they are, how they're doing at math. Whereas people with a growth mindset, they're the people who are going to be embracing challenge. They're going to persist when something's hard rather than feel, oh, I just can't do it and give up. They see effort as going to be, that's the way that they're going to get better. They're the people who learn from criticism, who are inspired when other people are doing well because they think, oh, they did well, I can do well too, rather than looking and seeing, oh, they did well, they're that kind of people, I'm the other kind of people. And so one of the things that this research is showing is that the mindset that you have about learning a new topic, in this case mathematics, has a lot to do with your long-term success.
Yes.
And students who have a growth mindset are really well positioned. Parents can and teachers can help kids have a growth mindset. There are a couple of really easy things to do in your classroom. The biggest thing, my favorite thing that I've learned in the last probably 2 or 3 years is the word yet. And so anytime anybody says, I'm not good at it, I can't do it, you know, this is way too hard for me, I learned the word yet. I'm not good at it. If I hear somebody say I'm not good at math, I just pipe in, yet.
Yeah.
God, it's too hard for me
right
now.
Right. Well, I just loved math so much. And then when I was introduced to algebra in the eighth grade, I just couldn't get it. And and so, you know, I was told to do a history of mathematics instead and to take algebra later, and I was just so surprised. But when I started Montessori training, I discovered that every concept had a concrete representation. So that everything was presented in a concrete fashion before you were asked to do it without the concrete representations. And so when you, in a Piagetian sense, if you were still in concrete operations, you could do the most advanced math problems using these materials. And then, you know, but for those kids who had, you know, who weren't in concrete operations, and so many of them were boys, they just went zooming along because they could do it all in their heads.
But this is a really important point, because one of the things that we learn, and this comes right out of this theory that Carol Dweck has been putting forth. I actually have a quote from her, or, you know, sort of something, a paraphrase of a quote for her, that talks about, like, the absolutely tragic consequences that we have, like, for America, for individuals, for as a society, when we don't, like you were saying, like, you have the perception of those kind of speedy boys that kept it all in their heads.
Yeah.
What happens, there's a certain point for most people, they hit the wall. You described hitting the wall at algebra. For those speedy kids, there may be a different time that they hit the wall, but the research shows that even people who start off thinking that they're good at math and they like it, like through elementary school, or they're those people that we perceive to be speedy, they're going to hit a wall at a certain part when it gets to be hard, when you can no longer memorize all those things, when they're no longer easy and obvious for you. All of us hit a wall at a certain point. And what happens if you've got that kind of fixed mindset, not a growth mindset, is you believe because you can't do it quickly anymore, because you can't memorize something or reproduce a procedure, that, oh, I guess I'm not good at math after all. And then people get this new self-image, like, oh, it's the people who were fast, the people who were speedy, those are the ones that are good at math. I was one of them. I used to be fast and speedy. I'm not anymore. I'm not good at math. And then people just kind of join the ranks of, like, the myriad of Americans who think they don't like math or believe that they're not good at math. And that goes back so much to that idea of yet and to that idea of speed that we've talked about already. If we don't slow it down and include, as you said, like the tactile models, the visual models, as well as the algebraic, as well as the memorization, if we're not operating and teaching our class with all of these modes of learning and attending to the fact that speed and quickness and the appearance of getting it is not the same as deep, profound understanding that has, you know, kind of legs and lasts from year to year, from schooling into careers and hobbies, we are doing ourselves as a society real harm.
I agree with you.
Great quote from another professor named Dylan Willems, and he found this he was in a classroom in England, and he found on the wall in a classroom a teacher who had a poster that said, "Stuck? Question mark? Good. It was worth coming in today." So she felt that if everything was moving along and it was too easy for kids, then that was a problem, because that meant they actually already knew the stuff and they weren't learning anything new.
Right.
And there's an important point. Like, if it's actually too easy and you're just doing everything really fast without thinking, you're not learning anything.
No.
As parents and teachers, we should help our kids learn to expect some struggle, because it's in that struggle moment that we're learning something new. That goes back, you had said, mentioned Piaget's name.
Right.
Piaget talked about that disequilibrium. That's the moment when you go from being like a little stuck and a little bit confused, and then all of a sudden you have that light bulb, aha.
Right. Problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
There's
so
many ways.
And so that's important, that parents Carol Dweck says, a big mistake parents make is that they tell their kids they should feel good when everything's easy and they're getting everything right. And Carol says, that's not a cause for celebration. That's a tragedy. That means you're not learning as much as you could. If everything was easy, you probably already knew it. Mm-hmm. You should be sad. You should go back to your teacher and demand a refund.
Right. Yeah, it. If you're engaged, then that's something to celebrate. Mm-hmm. And if it's boring and easy, then you're not engaged. Well, how does this work?
Learning.
How does this work that connect to the new Common Core standards that have been adopted by most states? How are these standards different from what we've been doing?
Well, there are a couple of ways that they're different. And the way that this connects for me, the most natural connection is that these standards, in addition to having very coherent and rigorous mathematical content standards, those are things like the computation, the geometry, algebra, proportional reasoning, statistics, the mathematical content that builds very coherently grade by grade. These set of standards also have 8 standards for mathematical practice. And we can think of those as the habits of mind that we want students to be developing as they move from kindergarten to 12th grade and exit into their careers. These habits of mind, they're basically, you can think about there's some overarching habits of mind. We want students to approach mathematics by making sense of problems and persevering in solving them and attending to precision. Precision in language, precision in numbers. That doesn't always mean be precise. What it means is pay attention to how precise do you need to be for this context. There are standards of practice that have to do with reasoning and communicating your reasoning, explaining. So things like construct a viable argument and critique the reasoning of others. Pay attention. That's also related to that make sense, but also communicate, being able to communicate those things. There are some standards for practice that have to do with modeling with mathematics, using tools appropriately, and tools that have to do with the mathematics itself. Looking for mathematical structure, looking for patterns, regularity, repeated reasoning, making generalizations. And all of those habits of mind are things that it's not just that the teacher needs to be able to do those things. It's not just the teacher needs to be able to make sense and articulate things, but the teacher needs to provide ongoing, consistent opportunities for the students to be developing these habits for themselves, because it's those habits that we need for 21st century life, not only 21st century workforce, but 21st century life. We are inundated with numbers and data and, you know, all of the financial crisis and the, you know, international economics, and but day-to-day things as well. And so those mathematical practices are something that really distinguish these standards. The other piece that really distinguishes them, that's so important for us as a country, is it's the first time that across state boundaries we've been able to talk about what we value in terms of our students' mathematical, growing mathematical understandings and how we want students to be developing. And these standards were written with input from universities and the workforce, and educational scholars and mathematicians. And so they really build a coherence. It used to be, you know, in California, our standards were put together by committee. And so the way that a committee would put together standards is you lock a whole group of arguably smart people in a room, and everybody would have their points that they really wanted. And if two different people disagreed on a standard, there were two ways that they would resolve it. Maybe you wanted a particular standard and I wanted a particular standard, and we were both very strong-minded, opinionated people on this committee, and we could make a compelling case, in which case we'd both get to put our standard in the... Maybe I didn't agree with yours and you didn't agree with mine, but we were both pretty outspoken, and I'd say, well, okay, Athena, I'll give you yours if you give me mine, in which case the standards got longer and longer and longer to accommodate the people on the committee. The other thing that happened was you and I, maybe there was the same thing, but we had slightly different opinions about it. We would write the standard in a watered-down way that really didn't communicate very much, but that way we were both in agreement that we could kind of accept the wording. Our California standards were extremely long, incoherent, and in many cases so vague that they weren't very useful for teachers. So the standards now are very coherent, and they enable teachers in California to have conversations with teachers in Colorado or Massachusetts or Wisconsin. And teachers can talk across state boundaries, and because students are the same whether they live in Boston or Ukiah. And so it gives some very powerful tools to teachers, teacher educators, and there's a great coherence to what we have.
Yes. So you've talked about all of the things you would really like about the Common Core math.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what criticisms you have of the Common Core?
So my criticisms actually are not specific to the standards themselves, but really to the way in which, as a nation, we are letting things be implemented, I guess I would say. And so there's some things that I wish we could do better. The critiques, I would say, are not specifically the standards. So one of the things that, you know, when you read, there are all kinds of blogs and articles about stuff. People tend to kind of mush together the standards and the way we're implementing them.
Uh-huh.
So one of my first big critiques, and this is not a critique of the standards, but again, a critique of the implementation, is that in this country, so many of our educational policies and decisions are deferred to big industry, and in particular to testing and textbook companies. So the way that things will be implemented in the schools are in large part going to reflect whatever textbooks get adopted. And the textbooks aren't necessarily being published in ways that are consistent with what is the intent, the spirit, and the actual content of the Common Core, because textbooks companies are big for-profit companies that are just trying to make a buck and sell, so they can slap a Common Core sticker on just about anything they want and have a good sales pitch, and some school's going to buy it. And then a teacher's going to get it and think, oh, well, this is the Common Core? This looks a lot like what I used to do. They just moved something from page 4 to page 42, and they moved that thing from page 69 up to page 13. And they put some stars next to a couple of particular problems that they say are rich Common Core problems. So that's going to be a big problem down the road. As more and more schools adopt curriculum materials that are not really in the spirit of the Common Core, we're going to have a lot of people saying, see, the Common Core didn't work, when really what didn't work was adopting curricula that was only superficially aligned with the Common Core and then telling teachers to implement it with fidelity, and then, surprise, surprise, it was ineffective.
Right, so it sets teachers up to fail.
Sets teachers up to fail, absolutely. And another thing that we're doing in the U.S. that is a systemic problem is we are neglecting the fact that almost all of the teachers in American schools currently are products of the education they received as children. Their mathematics foundation is based upon the mathematics education that they received, which did not have depth and coherence and was not based on making sense of the mathematics and constructing viable arguments. Those pieces that I articulated that are part of the Common Core mathematical practices were not part of either current teachers' experiences in elementary, middle, high school, or university math classes for the most part, and nor were they part of most teachers' university teacher preparation. And that's very important, and we need to take very seriously the importance of training, providing teachers ongoing opportunities for professional learning that look deeply at how to shift their teaching practices to incorporate opportunities for engaging in different kinds of math lessons, like the ones that I'm going to be putting forth in the book.
Great.
Teachers know how to teach that one typical traditional U.S. lesson. It is hard to learn how to teach a different kind of lesson. It's hard to get better at it. It's hard to do it when you're trying to teach new math content. All of those things need a school system that respects teachers as professionals who need opportunities to learn things. And right now, there's very little time and energy devoted to giving teachers time to do things like observe their peers who are a step ahead of them, take time to meet with peers and analyze curriculum, do something called lesson study. There's so many ways to help give teachers those opportunities for real professional learning, and our country's kind of notorious for not taking that time. And then, as you said, blaming the teachers when it doesn't work well.
Right, blaming the teachers. And the defamation of character of teachers in this country has just been so terrible. It breaks my heart, really. Well, could you share an excerpt from your manuscript with us?
Yeah, so just one last piece that I think kind of fits with what we've been talking about.
The Common Core.
It fits with the Common Core and shifts and implications of what happens if we keep teaching the ways that we have been teaching. So I'll just kind of finish this up by reading a bit of that. By teaching math lessons the way we have always taught them, we teach students to believe that math is mostly about solving highly predictable problems with given methods. It's not. In the real world, 21st century people use mathematics to solve complex, novel, and messy problems throughout their daily lives. And some of our math lessons should reflect that. By teaching lessons the way we always have taught them, we teach students to believe that they must rely upon their book and their teacher to tell them how to do math. But they shouldn't. Better, they should learn to rely upon their own reasoning and intuition. Many real mathematical questions don't follow predictable pathways, and some don't even have answers. Some of our math lessons should reflect that. By teaching our math lessons the way we always have, we teach students to believe that being good at math is to memorize easily, compute quickly, and be able to learn a new procedure within a day. But that's not true. Important concepts and skills take time to develop. This fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of mathematical thinking has led to countless Americans believing that they are not good at math and don't like math. In truth, mathematical thinking has very little to do with speed or memory. It has to do with reasoning. People who are good at math know that any problem worth solving is worth spending a lot of time on. In fact, if you already know how to solve it, it really isn't a problem. Students need to work on authentic problem situations. Some of our math lessons should reflect that. By teaching math lessons the way we have taught students to believe that if you're really working hard at doing math, you're probably not very good at it. This has tragic consequences both for individuals and for our society. We need to help students learn that if you're working really hard at math, you're probably going to get better. Some of our math lessons need to reflect that. And finally, by teaching math lessons the way we always have, we teach students to believe that the better you are at math, the less you have to think about it. By definition, mathematics is the intellectual and practical activity encompassing a systematic study of structure and behavior, of number and quantity and space. When we say or imply, just memorize it, just follow a procedure that was given, and when we expect students to complete 50 or 30 or more problems in a half an hour, we send them a clear message that they just had better not think too much. There isn't any time, and that isn't the point. But thinking is the point of math lessons, and all of our math lessons should reflect that.
Well, it sounds wonderful, Kathy.
Thank you.
Do you have a name for the book?
Yeah, so the tentative title, it's just a manuscript at this point, but the tentative title is Lessons for the Common Core.
Lessons for the Common Core.
Yes.
Is that right? And do you know when it'll be available?
Well, I'm hoping to have the manuscript completed by December, and I have a publisher that is interested. So I haven't signed a contract yet, but I have an interested publisher. So I'm hoping sometime next year.
Oh, that's just wonderful, Kathy. It's exciting. It's really exciting. Now, I recently read an article regarding the success of Finland schools, which are rated number one nationally. Mm-hmm. And the article stated, this is a quote, "We visitors to the United States often wonder why innovations that have brought improvement to all successful education systems have not been embedded in the U.S. school system. One reason may be that the work of the school in the United States is so steered by bureaucracies, test-based accountability, and competition that schools are simply doing what they must do in this situation. Many visitors from the United States to Finland conclude their observations by saying that Finnish education looks like the U.S. education in the 70s and 80s. And that article is called Five Innovations That Help Finland Schools Improve, But That U.S. Reformers Now Ignore. It was in the Washington Post answer sheet by Valerie Strauss. And would you care to comment on this report, Kathy? The reason I found it so interesting is it sounds like that Finland got all of its ideas, innovation, and training here from people like you, right? From those people who teach it. But then we don't do it here in this country.
It's been going on for years, and I think that's exactly right. It's a fascinating thing. The innovations, two of the innovations that the article talks about specifically are in elementary classrooms in particular, in primary classrooms, that Finnish schools found and worked on having more use of explanations about what was going on mathematically by the students, and also relating more of the problems that students were doing to everyday life through things like projects or, you know, the truck with the books picture,
right,
that I used as an example. Those are exactly the kinds of things that U.S. Educational scholars have been talking about since the 80s. Mm-hmm. And schools like Finland have been, districts in Finland and also nationally, they've been able to implement those things in large part because they take teacher learning seriously. They take the time to give teachers an opportunity to learn. They hold teacher learning and also principal learning in very high esteem. They put money towards it. But another thing that I learned, and so they build that into their calendar. So a statistic that I read recently is that while teachers in the U.S. and teachers in Finland are paid for roughly the same amount of time, something like American teachers are teaching 1,100 hours in a school year. Like, that's the number of hours, roughly the same number of school days. In Finland, they're teaching 600 and something hours, and those other 400 and something hours are being used for professional collaboration, teacher growth, teacher learning new curriculum, that's really valued. And that's one of the things that we find in many of these international comparisons. And it's not just Finland. In Japan, too, is another example where much of what makes the Japanese approach to mathematics teaching, and my expertise is in the elementary schools, what makes them so successful is the things that they learned, again, from U.S. educational research that came out in the 80s.
Right.
They changed much of their curriculum based on what we were recommending, but what we never were able to successfully implement.
Well, I the only place I disagree with you is that we did implement it. We started implementing it in the 60s.
Started.
And so it was happening in little pockets. And, you know, And we addressed the poverty issue and everything by, you know, offering early childhood education, parent education to as soon as parents got pregnant. And so that, you know, it followed along in low class size, and, you know, it was all so holistic. And then when Reagan was elected governor, it all came apart. It always devalued. And the other thing in Finland,
throughout the country, again, like in the 60s and in the 70s and in the 80s, there were many important initiatives that we started.
Right.
But there's some very good research by a fellow named David Cohn, who's at the University of Michigan. In fact, there was an article, a really wonderful article in the New York Times magazine last week.
Yes.
Called Why Do Americans Stink at Math? It's a very provocative title. Why do Americans stink at math? And Cohn talks about how in the many classrooms in the 60s, well, he's speaking specifically about the reforms in the 80s, there were a lot of surface level changes, but when you dug in deeper, you could see, for example, that teachers were simply taking new math problems, for example, and putting them back into their same old lesson, even though they were getting some support and they were making some changes, they weren't really making those deep and systemic changes, and they weren't encouraged to sustain them for very long because they were challenging. So that's another article I would really recommend to people.
Well, please send me a link. Please send me a link, and I'll include it in the promotion. I'll include it in the promotion as something that we discussed during the show, if you send me a link. Well, Kathy, this has just been wonderful.
Thank you.
And it's an honor to have you as a guest, and it's also an honor to have you as a board member of the Hermeneutic Institute, which produces Education Now. So just thank you so much for the time and just for everything that you do. And I just am really looking forward to seeing this manuscript as a book, in book form.
Me too.
And once again, thank you so very much. It was just really a pleasure to have you on again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
You are on the road, must have a code. that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.